Ah, shit! You listen to the James McMahon Music Podcast. I'm your host, James McMahon, and this is a Spook Media production. Bit of a dream come true, this one. 40 minutes with Lee Ronaldo, guitarist in one of my favourite bands, Sonic Youth. Sometimes I have to pinch myself, I really do. If you told me at 14 that one day I'd get to talk to a member of actual Sonic Youth about songwriting, Nirvana, Donald Trump, all sorts of stuff, well, I would have probably asked who's Donald Trump, but you get my point. I would have been in severe disbelief. Hey, remind me to tell you sometime about the time I helped Thurston Moore steal a sofa from the enemy office. Just how much trouble I got into for doing so. Now is not the time, but do remind me. We also talk about Lee's newest release, In Virus Times, an instrumental acoustic piece that comprises four parts, written and performed by Lee in his flat during those strange COVID-drenched days when lockdown shut down the world. It's perhaps Lee's most human, in his words, least arch, and there's something almost paranormal about the recording, like a fingerprint left on time itself. It's fitting, and this is a nice way to explain away some of the noisy audio you're about to hear, is it not? That during the recording, you can hear fire trucks passing by and the murmur of other humans there and thereabouts. It's out November 12th on the Great Mute Records. Don't sleep on that one. If you do me a favour and rate, review and subscribe to this podcast, then I'd really appreciate it. It helps the podcast scoot up the rankings, gets it heard by more people, and makes me feel so much less insecure. I also run a Substack at Spook, where I write about music, film, TV, video games, Bigfoot, football, all sorts of things. And maybe you'd like to investigate my record label, Spook Records, on Bandcamp. I do a few other podcasts too, an episodic exploration of shame called Shame, and the OCD Chronicles, which is just about to conclude its second season, but do that in a bit, in about 40 minutes time in fact. First, here's Lee. Enjoy the episode.
We don't want to scare anybody.
It's really nice to get the opportunity to talk to you. I've been a fan of your music for feels like all my life, really. So it's a buzz. I'm trying to think, actually. Obviously, living in London, I semi regularly bump into Thurston, kind of mooching around. Yeah, kind of mooching around Stoke Newington. You know, he's always in Rough Trade East, just off Brick Lane. But I'm not sure I've ever had a conversation with anyone else from Sonic Youth. So it's a real buzz, this.
Okay, nice. And this is for your podcast?
I do a music podcast. I do a bunch of podcasts, but I'm not sure that a conversation with Lee Ronaldo would make much sense on a podcast about OCD or Shame, which is my other two podcasts. But yeah, just for the music podcast. I was actually talking to Ryan from the Cribs about doing this. I've known those guys for years and years. And
oh, yeah, I love those guys.
Yeah, you reconnected with them during lockdown, didn't you? You did a remote live stream thing.
Yeah, we did one or two things, I think, during the lockdown. We did a live stream thing, and we did, or I guess I did some videotaping for their, and I sang on their video for a song that came out after. We did a couple things during live stream. Those guys are super cool. I've got Ryan sent me one of his signature model Fenders, so I've been playing that a lot here.
Oh, nice, man. I mean, we're sort of jumping straight into it here, and I'm sort of doing this all the wrong way around, but if we're talking guitars, I've always thought if I ever got the opportunity to speak to you, I would ask you about your Moonlander, because I always just as someone who plays the guitar now and then, I used to look at that instrument and think, I don't really understand how it works. Do you play that often, or?
You know, it's a very weird thing about that guitar, because the guy that made it is the Dutch man named Yuri Landman, and we've been longtime friends and associates, and I currently use a bunch of instruments that he built, but that guitar is one of the first things that he built for me. And I guess at some point he posted a picture of it on my wiki page or something like that. I don't know, but everyone always asks about that guitar, but it's not a guitar. It's such a crazy instrument that it's been exhibited on gallery walls much more than it's been actually played, I think, because I've used it a little bit in the studio. I don't think I've ever used it in a live performance. I mean, maybe it's time to use it in a live performance. I don't know. It's such a beast of an instrument to sort of figure out how to use. It's amazing conceptually and like visually, but I've never really figured out how to do much with it that would work in a live performance situation. So it's one of a handful of novelty guitars we've had over the years, built for Sonic U. Steve Albini famously built a 16 string, all high E string, guitar called the Sonic 16, I think is what it was called. And it had a inlaid phallus in the headstock, which was typical for Steve Albini, I guess. But that's another guitar that we kind of fooled around with in the studio and sent to a couple different exhibits and things, but didn't really play very much.
Yeah. I always just presumed that it was kind of designed to almost be used as a regular electric guitar, but with the option to use a bow as well.
Yeah, I suppose so. Except as a regular electric guitar, it was it's so heavy in the wrong places that it doesn't really hang over your neck very easily. It like the headstock wants to plummet straight to the floor because it's so heavy on that end. And it's, you know, I guess you have to play it either on a tabletop or certainly sitting down. You know, it's not a very easy guitar to wear. It's very heavy and awkwardly balanced.
I'm going to have to put a link to a picture of it in the show notes, because there may well be people who aren't as in as deep into the guitars you play as me that may be just thinking, what on earth are they talking about right now? But I'll stick a picture in there.
Yeah, that'd be good.
So I want to ask you about in virus times. I mean, you know, we've got half an hour, and to talk about all the music you make would take a lot longer than that. But I think that obviously that's the record is due. When's it out?
I think it's out November 12th, November 11th or 12th. I think it's the 12th.
I was reading that you made it in September last year, so it'll be almost just a little bit
about
over
a year ago.
Yeah. I mean, it really does, and it's very fitting that I can hear a police car beeping.
Yeah, I closed the windows because we live across the street from City Hall, and lately there's been protests every day. So besides the sirens, there's like people banging on drums and, you know, trumpeting trumpets and things like that. And it's quite cacophonous outside, so I shut the windows to see if I could lessen it a little bit.
No, it's all good.
I can get it.
No, it's okay. All good. It's like when you listen to a record, I always like to hear the sort of the sound of fingers on a fretboard. You know what I mean? Like, I love all that stuff. Which is my way of saying to people who listen to this podcast, I'm sorry that it's not always perfect audio. But
and actually, in virus times, has the sound of sirens coming in the window because I recorded it here at home and. On a late night evening situation, sitting in the dark with the windows open, and every once in a while you hear police sirens or fire trucks going by or whatever.
Well, that's why I said I thought it was almost like a snapshot of how I felt at that moment in time. I was trying to think what did I feel like in September 2020, and I didn't quite feel like the world was ending. That I maybe did do a couple of months prior.
Yeah.
But I definitely felt kind of weird mixture of sort of like sadness, fatigue, but also a bit of sort of hope that the world was opening up a bit. And that's kind of, I mean, obviously, you know, music's subjective and I'm sure different people get different things from it, but that's what I took from it anyway. Where was your head at?
Well, I get something similar from the mood that I was in when I recorded it. I mean, you know, it was, we were going into the fall. We'd now, at that point, I suppose we'd been in sort of a lockdown sort of situation for maybe 6 months, and unclear, you know, as all of a sudden the summer was ending, the days were getting darker. Nobody knew how long this was going to go on. On top of which, we had the whole business with the coming elections in our country and you know, the specter of the possibility of Trump getting reelected. So we had these two incredibly anxiety provoking situations kind of compounding each other. And you know, for me, I had my last record before this came out about a week before we went into lockdown in the US anyway. We came out the very end of February, and like within a week or two later, we were in lockdown and all gigs were getting canceled and all everything was getting canceled basically. And so it was a very frustrating time for me. I didn't really, having just completed a record, I wasn't motivated to sort of start writing new music or anything like that. And I actually didn't touch most of my instruments for a bunch of months. And I threw myself into some other things. I was drawing and painting and doing some visual art projects, but I was a bit frustrated with the idea of what to do musically, you know, having just put out a record and planned live shows and sort of a stage setup and all that kind of stuff. And so I didn't do much for a while. And over the summer, I kind of got started again. And this night in September, it was dark. We were listening to the television broadcast about, you know, even then before the election, this they were anticipating Trump trying to steal the election if he didn't win. And, you know, there was a level of anxiety that was just incredibly high. And I just sat down one night with the guitar after not really playing very much for quite a while and started developing these few really simple themes. And just, you know, I kind of liked it. So I set up some proper microphones. Obviously, I'm in my living room at this point. Our studio was still shut at that point. And kind of made a down-home recording of what was going on. And I recorded for, I don't know, an hour and a half or more, you know, quite a long session. And then I spent the next couple months kind of structuring the piece and editing it down to what you hear on the record. And at the beginning, it even had a clip from the television news at the very head of it, you know, talking about Trump and Biden and all this, you know, political anxiety, which at the time I thought actually kind of pegged it to this moment in time and gave it kind of this framework for the mood of that piece. And then when MSNBC wouldn't let us use the clip, just because they never let anybody use those kind of clips for any other purpose, we removed it. And even though I was kind of fighting to keep it, it felt like it freed the music to be just to be what it was. And, yeah, you know, who wants to hear at this moment in time now, you know, in October 2021, who wants to hear about Trump stealing the election or any of that bullshit anymore? So it was fortuitous that they wouldn't let us use it, because I probably would have left it on there. And to me, it just reflects the mood that I was in at that moment. You know, it was kind of dark in my house when I was recording. I was playing very minimally. I was just kind of listening to these simple chords, kind of like, you know, striking them and listening to them like bloom and decay in the air. Very similar to the way I was drawing. I was drawing a lot of flowers through that whole year, and drawing, my wife was bringing flowers home to kind of brighten the apartment since we were stuck inside. And I was drawing them when they were fresh, and then when they were dying, and then when they were dead. And, you know, I was kind of playing these chords in a similar fashion, like letting each one kind of like empty out into the room, and not really pushing myself to get anything complex happen, but just really sitting and listening. You know, the streets were empty. Everything felt kind of empty and like in a kind of stasis moment. You know, we weren't moving forward or backwards. We were kind of stopped and locked. And I don't know, I really felt like the music reflected that in a very pure and genuine way. You know, I wasn't like calculating what I wanted to do. I never imagined that those recordings were going to turn into a record. I just kind of wanted to have a good recording for my own right at that moment. And so I feel like when I listen to it, I feel like it's the least kind of arch or preconceived music that I've maybe ever released, because it just kind of happened so very naturally. And then the process, you know, I showed it to Mute almost never thinking that they were going to go for it. You know, I thought I'd end up giving it to some small indie label. There's a label out in California that kind of specializes in solo acoustic guitar records, and I thought I'd have a small release on that label or something like that. But Mute really responded to it, and, you know, maybe as a record of the times or whatever. And it was their idea to make it a one-sided record and do an etching on the backside and turn it into this kind of interesting package with the signed poster and all that stuff. And so it's definitely one thing I love about the label is that they're really thinking about their artists, and, you know, they kind of know where their artists have been before. They knew I'd done some etched sides of vinyl in previous releases, and that I was making visual art by scratching on old records and doing sort of small editions of these etchings. And so they were kind of thinking on their feet about it, which I really appreciated. And things just came together.
That's really interesting you saying about it almost like being like maybe the least arch thing you've ever done, because that's really how I felt about it, actually, was that I guess that as a fan of the music that you've made, principally with Sonic Youth, like, yep, my favorite bits of Sonic Youth are the bits that are quite pop. Like, I like, you know, I love Goo, I love Dirty. Like, I love like the pop element of it. And I guess, sure, that, and there's so much music, I feel like, with Sonic Youth, is it's quite an interesting challenge for the listener, in that I almost feel like Sonic Youth are like a band like The Fall. And when I say Sonic Youth, I mean like Sonic Youth and the individual projects of the members of Sonic Youth. Like, they're almost like, oh, the almost like The Fall, in the sense that I don't know whether people like everything by The Fall, because they went to so many different places. And I feel like that a bit about Sonic Youth. And I feel like sometimes, sure, I've maybe zoned out a little bit with stuff that has been, this is really crude, but like artier. And I felt, sure, and I felt like with this recording, I feel like I'm getting a real insight into your soul, in a sense.
I like it. I like that. You know, I mean, I really feel like it was very, very open and bare, in terms of like bearing, you know, like I said, not calculated at all. Just kind of really, when I was making the recordings, I was just playing for myself and didn't have any plan for it at all. And then just as a early winter project or autumn project, you know, okay, I'll take this 90 minutes of music and see if I can really shape it into something. Because while I was sat playing, I was, you know, going from one theme to another and back again, and kind of envisioning ways in which one could actually structure a piece of music where certain kind of sonic elements, sonic themes would come and go. And it was just, you know, it was a kind of a project just to occupy my early autumn months there, when nothing was happening. We were still mostly stuck inside at that point. We were still in that period, I think, of wiping down the doorknobs and all that kind of stuff when you came in, and you know, different people were more or less freaked out about that moment in time, but certainly you weren't casually entering shops, or, you know, you were going to the food store to do your shopping if you had to, or you were I wasn't spending much time out of the apartment at all, except maybe to take some bike rides or something like that, you know. And I was just kind of making it for myself, you know. Like I said, I didn't even close the windows. Siren sounds are coming in. You can hear at points sort of the mumble of people talking in the background in the next room and things like that. And, you know, it was just done in a very pure manner. You know, it was, you know, there's always something arch about, like, when you know you're going to make a record, and whether you're going into a recording studio or whatever the situation is, it immediately kind of compromises the situation a little bit. You know, I mean, some of my favorite recordings of Sonic Youth, I mean, when we finally got a little bit of money in the mid 90s and established our own studio, We had a situation where, like, every time we were in the studio, we were recording. And so we kind of forgot about the fact that we were recording. And we went from a band that, you know, to make a record, you'd woodshed all your pieces, and you'd go into the studio and you'd have a week or 2 weeks to, like, capture definitive versions of these songs you've been working on for months. And it's almost an impossible task to be spontaneous in that context, although, you know, we did manage it a fair bit of the time. But once we got our own studio, the tape was just running constantly, and we just forgot about it, and we're playing in a very you know, open way, and not thinking about, you know, getting a perfect take or anything like that. And we found that some of the records we made after that, like after Washing Machine, especially that record A Thousand Leaves, where that was really the first record we made in our own studio, where we were off the clock. We were you know, just we'd play the same song over and over again as we were working on it. And, you know, we'd all put our instruments down at the end of a certain session and say like, wow, that felt like a really great take. And then we'd walk into the next room and it was recorded, and it was, you know, it was kind of a naturalistic version of it rather than this high pressure, like bright lights on you, like, you know, perform like a trained monkey or something like that in the studio. Yeah, so I've always liked records that sounded like that, you know, or where you can hear, you know, you can hear the group playing live in a studio or the artist playing live in a studio, as opposed to it being all broken down and like overdubbed and calculated one instrument at a time.
Little snapshots of life in a sense, you know.
Yeah.
Do you miss it?
What?
Sonic Youth.
You know, I don't really miss it. And I think, you know, it's been just about 10 years since we stopped playing, I think, at this point, from 2011 to 2021. And the band as a entity or a concept or whatever you will have it, for those of us that were in it, it hasn't really stopped. You know, there's a constant stream of like business decisions, and you want to make a new t-shirt, or we're repackaging old material, or we're finding live sessions to put out and things like that. Or, you know, somebody wants to use a song in a movie or whatever it is. And, you know, so the sort of business communication between the four of us and our management and label has kind of been ongoing. So in a sense, it hasn't stopped. And you know, my friendship with Thurston and Kim and Steve and Jim and Mark hasn't stopped at all through this whole period. And so it's still there. It's still with me in a lot of ways. I mean, I suppose after 30 years of being a band together, there's a point where it almost never ends. You know, it's ended for new recordings and new working together and things like that for the fans, I suppose. But I wouldn't trade this last 10 years in terms of all the opportunity it's afforded each of us individually to kind of like, you know, plow our own row or whatever it is. You know, I think there was a tension, especially in the last decade of our three decades together, I think there was a little bit of tension between the stuff that we were doing together and some of the various activities that each of us were getting up to on our own. And, you know, you were never, because Sonic Youth was always so active, we were never really able to fully devote ourselves to a lot of these other things that were on our mind, whether it was, you know, for Kim or I, like exhibiting artwork or, you know, writing books or doing fashion or, you know, whatever it might have been. And this kind of break from Sonic Youth really allowed us to kind of like go full force into those things. And I think, I don't know, I don't think any of us would want to trade the opportunity of this last 10 years to do all the other things that we've been doing. Sometimes when you're in a group situation and the group is, you know, getting accolades and attention and all that stuff, it's hard to, you know, the group is getting those accolades, and it's hard to separate it out into like, well, what the individual members are, you know. And we were always such a collective of a band. Like, we always felt like everything we did was an amalgam of the four of us working, no matter who was singing or on the camera or, you know, whatever it was in the videos. And you know, it's been nice to have this time to just each sort of sink or swim on our own, I guess.
Totally. I mean, you know, if we're lucky, it's a long life, and Sonic Youth existed for a long time. I guess.
Yeah, 30 years, you know. I mean, the Velvet Underground, I just saw that new documentary that Todd Haynes did. You know, they were around for 4 or 5 years, and you know, the Beatles for 7 or 10, or, you know, whatever it was.
I was doing some writing recently about Nevermind, and I was just thinking about just what a blip Nirvana.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
It's just.
Yeah, they were a blinding blur in the scheme of things. Two or 3 or 4 years or something like that. You know, 3 or 4 different drummers in that period of time.
Yeah, wild, you know. Man, wild.
Yeah,
but no, I see what you're saying about Sonic Youth, and that's what I thought you were going to say, and I think that's almost perfect sense. We were saying before about you briefly broached upon politics, or like the landscape. And I, you know, I think like a lot of empathetic, smart, decent people. We do look at the world and think there's a lot of problems in the world. And I guess that with you being, you're older than me and live longer and live through more change, unrest, turmoil, you know, shifting tides. Has there been this era, however you want to define that, is it an anomaly? Is it unlike what you've experienced before, or is it just part of the cycle of humans trying to make sense of living on this this ball of earth?
You mean the political era you're talking about?
Well, just all of it, really. The culture. I just think I have a lot of conversations with musicians on this podcast where of an age, you know, because, you know, I'm ultimately, you know, a fan of alternative music or indie rock or punk rock or whatever you want to call it. I was having a conversation with Mac from Superdrunk the other day, and he was talking about he just didn't understand the world in a way that he did at one point. And that's kind of, I think that's sort of, that's quite unique, I think, for someone when they're getting older. I mean, obviously someone like Trump is an anomaly, but does the world make sense to you now?
Well, you know, I don't know about the world making sense, and I don't really even know about him being an anomaly. I mean, he's an anomaly in our current moment, just because, especially here in this country, you'd never imagine that anyone that was as bald-faced a con man could achieve, you know, what he did and be elected president. But I mean, if you look at history, there's always been moments where someone like that, you know, whether it's the Hitlers and Mussolinis or just the cheap petty crooks that got elected to office or whatever, you know, here in New York, we had Tammany Hall and all this kind of stuff where, you know, basically mobsters were running the government for a period of time or the city. And it's not that much of an anomaly. And I just think, I don't know, I think some of those things just come around in cycles. You know, we were at a moment of deep unrest here in our country, and this is what happened. And we're also, you know, we're on this hump of new technology, you know, the digital age and like all the impact that, you know, Facebook and all this other social media stuff had on the last couple elections and probably will continue to have going forward. And I just think society and history is constantly going through certain growing pains that are not very easy to understand, you know, and there's always people trying to push society forward and there's others always trying to hold it back, you know, and there's people trying to divest power and there's others trying to hold on to the power that they have. And, you know, in a way, those things never change. And we just kind of ride through it and kind of scratch, you know, you scratch your head and wonder about the people that seem to be holding society back or trying to pull us in the wrong direction, in a sense. And you know, obviously Trump and all of his cronies in our country, you know, as well as all over the world, you know, Bolsonaro, you know, I mean, you could make a list of these guys. And I don't know. You know, I mean, it's hard to figure that stuff out. I mean, it's almost not even worth trying to figure it out. It's, as you know, it's a kind of bang your head against the wall frustration.
Yeah, I mean, everything you're saying is almost what I was expecting you to say, and I guess how I genuinely feel. I mean, is your approach to art, do you see it as like when you're creating, are you soaking in this stuff, or is it an escape from this stuff?
Well, I think it's a little of both. I think you're always informed by all that stuff, and you kind of hope that even if you're not writing sort of like protest songs, that you're reflecting some element. Like, I mean, even with this new record, I think there's something about the anxiety and the frustration of that year that we were in the middle of when I made these recordings that, you know, I feel it comes out through the music, this kind of empty quality that reflects, like you look out the window, there's nobody on the streets, there's no cars, there's no nothing happening. And, you know, the other thing I was going to say before about that is just the fact that this is the first time something like this has happened on such a global scale where, like, it wasn't localized. You know, this wasn't the war in Afghanistan or the Falkland Islands or something like that. It was the entire planet that was going through this. And that may be a first in history, in a sense of like all of humanity kind of undergoing this kind of crisis at the same time. It really knocked it home in a certain way of, you know, making the world seem very small and making the fact that we're all divided little countries that each tried to deal with it in our own way seemed very kind of stupid almost. You know, it's like there's a global problem that people are trying to solve locally. I don't know. It's just, I think what's happened in this last year or two for people that want to look for harbingers to the future, it really points towards a lot of the things we're going to face going forward. You know, I think, you know, I keep saying, I think this is going to be a century of pandemics, you know, with the way that people travel around the world these days and the way invasive species and whether it's viruses or bugs or whatever kind of cross borders, it just seems like, you know, going forward, there's going to be more of this kind of thing happening. And, you know, this was kind of a dress rehearsal to some degree. I'm not sure I answered your question.
No.
That long ramble.
No, totally. I can see all that. I guess it's that thing, isn't it, where there's that phrase, isn't there, like, you know, about living in extraordinary times, almost like it's an honour to live in extraordinary times. But sometimes you do feel a little bit like, can I handle all of this?
Yeah. But, you know, like somebody asked me yesterday or a couple of days ago in an interview about, we were talking about New York, and they were talking about, you know, the glory days of New York, whether that was the late 70s kind of punk rock era or the 50s of John Coltrane and Jack Kerouac or the 20s, you know, whatever it was. And they were like, well, you know, do you feel the city's gone downhill or whatever with all these changes? And, you know, New York is a place, to me, that has always been about change. And, you know, if it didn't change, it would turn into Disneyland or something like that. Like, oh, there's the place where John Coltrane played 40 years ago. It's still preserved in amber. You know, it's like, that's not New York. They knock those buildings down and build new ones and have something else happen. And in a way, I think that's healthy. So I don't mourn this kind of nostalgia for the past. And, you know, whether it's, you know, on any level, not just talking about New York City, but in the context of what we're talking about, I think that, you know, things just change and evolve and you have to kind of roll with it and slowly try, you know, one step forward, two steps back to make things better as one can, you know?
Yeah, I that sums up New York to a T for me. This is going to sound like it's coming out of total left field, but do you think you'll do anything drift related again?
Well, Leah and I still work together all the time. We don't really call it drift anymore. We've had a couple different names for it since then. But this idea of, you know, electric guitar performance in a real performance setting with the films, we definitely still do that. We did one live stream event during the pandemic to support a local children's arts community here in our neighborhood. And although we don't have anything immediately planned, I mean, the idea of doing that kind of work the way we've been doing, you know, I've since the early days now, my guitar is suspended from a cord and sort of swinging around. And usually I'm in the center of them. You know, we do it in the round when we can, where I'm in the center and the audience is all around and then the films are around them. And so we're still definitely doing it. And we're both still interested in this idea of performances that incorporate film and live performance, whether it's just me or whether I've got other people on stage or whatever. So it's definitely an ongoing project. And it's, you know, it's been evolving since we started it in the early 90s when we were still using analog 16mm projectors for the visuals. But yeah, we'll definitely do more.
I guess the other thing I was thinking was, you know, we were talking a bit about guitars early on, but do you ever feel like you've mastered the guitar or does it still provide intrigue or opportunities that you hadn't thought of before? Is it still an instrument that's still, I don't know, like, I wonder whether... I mean, do you ever sit down at a piano, for example, or is the guitar still your instrument?
No, I play the piano quite often, and it's an instrument that I love, and I wish I was better on it. I'm not really, but I've had pianos in my house growing up. My mom was a pianist, so I've always been kind of plunking around on a piano. And you know, as far as the guitar. The idea of mastering it is impossible for me to imagine for myself. And, you know, I still find there's, you know, we always used to say that it seemed to have limitless possibilities. And and opportunities. And I still feel that way about it. You know, I have not played a lot of guitar over the last, over this whole pandemic period. I've kind of gone to it in spurts, and the making of this record was one such moment where I was renewing my interest in the guitar. And I almost, you know, I mean, if you listen to that record, it's so rudimentary that it's almost like starting from scratch and just building the most simple chords and seeing how they sound, and a couple simple little, you know, melodic lines or whatever. But I often wish that that I had more skill at the guitar and had more dexterity and these kind of things. I'm sort of pushing myself to get back in shape on it at the moment. I think finally the spark of interest is coming back. But, you know, pre-pandemic, in the last few years of making those last couple records, Electric Trim and Names of North End Women, I was deeply immersed in what I felt like was new discoveries and new understandings of the way they use the guitar and the different tunings and the way to play. And I was playing a lot and feeling like not a sense of mastery, but feeling like, you know, I could do almost anything that I had an idea to do in my mind, that like my fingers were kind of capable, not capable of playing like blinding scales, but I wasn't interested in that anyway. But, you know, if I had an idea of what to do, I was in pretty good practice at that point. And it seemed like, you know, the possibilities are endless. There's always, you know, I'm whenever I'm working on something, I'm putting little sound files down on my iPhone or a cheap tape recorder or something. And there's so much stuff that gets discarded and not returned to, that you think like, oh, this really has potential to be something, but you can't do everything, so some of it just gets put by the wayside. But in terms of potential and opportunity, I find it limitless. And both the, you know, to me, the piano and the guitar are two really special instruments, because they're each in their own way kind of orchestral. You know, they can be, you know, they're not like a horn or a woodwind where you're playing single note lines. I mean, you have this opportunity to play chords and to accompany yourself, to play moving bass lines and melodic top lines. And you can do that on the piano even more so than the guitar. But both of them are kind of these perfect instruments for accompanying a singing voice or whatever. So they have so much potential. It's never going to diminish, really.
I think that's the perfect place for us to wrap this up, Lee. Thanks so much for speaking to me. It's been awesome.
Okay, same here. It's been really nice talking with you. Where are you located? Are you in London?
I'm in London. Yeah, I'm out east. From Yorkshire.
Oh,
originally.
Okay.
I'm from Yorkshire originally. I saw something you play a bunch of times in. I think I saw you playing Leeds and Sheffield when I was a teenager. I've been in London as long as I remember. But hopefully one day I'll get over for a show and I'll say hello.
Yeah, I would love to. You know, those things are coming back slowly, I guess. I actually, you know, after 20 months of nothing, I played two shows this week within 3 days of each other, and they were my first shows since all this has kind of gone down. And I feel like I'm just casually dipping my feet into the water. I'm not ready to run out and book a tour or anything like that. But, you know, I was kind of resistant to it, I must say, not for COVID reasons, but I sort of feel like, you know, I think a lot of people were, you know, just ready to erase this last 18 months and say, like, let's just pick up where we left off in February 2020 and go right back where we were. And I'm kind of feeling the reverse of that, where I'm kind of feeling like when I do go out seriously to start being in public again as a performer, I want to have a sense of renewal, and like that something, you know, obviously I think for everyone, something changed during this time. And I want to feel like going forward that I can reflect the fact that things have changed in some way and not just, you know, plug back into all the same tropes and things that I was doing in the past. So I'm kind of taking it slow and doing some diverse different live performance things. But yeah, I'd love to come get back at some point to, you know, visiting some of these places that I love to be in, and London is certainly one of those. So hopefully at some point it will happen.
I look forward to it, Lee. All right, man.
Yeah.
Take care. Thanks so much for your time.
All right, James. Take care, you too.
Well, that's episode 20. Thanks to Lee for the conversation. Thanks to Zoe Miller for making it happen. The theme tune is by a band of jobbers. And I'll see you soon. Thank you.